Great. Thank you, Eric. I think we can now directly pass on to the second section, which means open discussion. You have half an hour to change the world here. I think if anybody might have come with the idea in mind, what can we do or what can the European Union do for farmers or rural areas? At latest, in this very moment, after the three speakers have talked to you, you will realize that this is the wrong question. The question is, what can farmers in rural areas contribute to master the great and necessary transition which we have to do in this century, away from a nuclear, fossil, carbon accumulating world to a bustling multitude of solar societies on this planet. And as we saw these two guys, Mr. Orr and Mr. Mansholt, here in black and white, the old founders of the current or very successful paradigm until today, please imagine in the year 2080, who still might be alive, in a similar conference, seeing Mr. Csolos here on the slide as being the one who opened, who pulled the handle, who opened the door for allowing a shift, a paradigm shift in policies which enabled rural areas and farmers to contribute to this great transition. Of course, this photograph would be in color this time, not black and white, but this would be the only difference. Disintegrated, depopulated rural areas cannot contribute. Impoverished and misguided farmers cannot contribute to this aim. So the question in practice is, how can we dismantle hindrances? How can we correct distortions to enable these actors to unfold their full potential? Please come up with ideas.
I think we've had some very interesting speakers this afternoon.
Could you tell your name? And
there it is. Sorry, I'm not speaking into my microphone. I'm from Ecovas, but I'm actually speaking as an ordinary mother of a family. We've heard some very interesting speakers about how farmers, how governments, how policymakers can do things that will make a difference. My worry is that the critical third partner in all of this is the consumer. How do you persuade the consumer about changing the eating habits of his or her lifetime? Most people think about how do they fill their children's mouths when they're hungry. Most children are not brought up in schools understanding about nutrition, and if you talk about it as nutrition, they would all switch off anyway. But it's understanding the value of the stuff that we grow, whether it's protein, carbohydrates, fats, or whatever, and how it's good for you, but also how it can taste good, because you won't change people's habits just by writing beautiful policies. And that is the main stumbling block. You will get people who are reasonably well educated will say, yes, I quite like the idea of this, I might change and do this, eat less meat. But the traditional family probably won't. Most people don't understand the nutrition of pulses, that actually you can eat pulses which are relatively cheap to buy, feed your family, and there are experiments that have been done with this. The traditional food basket that all television programs and governments promote are not stuff which are the best nutritious food basket you can have. And somehow you've got to get those messages clear and simple to ordinary people if you want to change the policies and have them accepted. You might have the most wonderful policies in the world. You might have all the governments believing in it. But if you don't get the ordinary common man believing in it, you're not going to get anywhere. I'm sorry, that sounds a bit like a soapbox, but it really worries me. And somebody said this morning, the most critical bit of all this is getting the promotion right so people will change their habits. But you don't change their habits by saying, look, this is a damn good idea, isn't it? It's got to be practical. It's something that they will enjoy doing. And food, after all, is something that people love to do. Sorry.
Yes. Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm a bit flabbergasted. Joseph Akapi, PAC 2013. I'm a bit flabbergasted by all of the interventions from the experts and all the material they have presented here to make sure that we can move on to a more sustainable agricultural and rural policy for the European Union. So thank you very much for the wealth and abundance of everything you showed us here. We understand that agriculture needs to be less of a burden for the environment, for our natural resources, not destroy biodiversity, be more compatible with water, and a number of proposals, for instance, aiming at diet be less composed of meat, but more contains more vegetables. All this is going in the right direction. As far as the environmental issues are concerned, there is one point I'd like to stress, which has not been commented sufficiently. That's climate change. Climate change, experts of the IPCC say that by the end of the century, that's a very short time, the temperature will rise by by 4 degrees, which is not the same as the politicians are saying, because they simply make declarations of intent and say that temperatures will only rise by 2 degrees centigrade. But climate change in that order of magnitude will certainly have a geographical, territorial impact, which can be very different from one region to another. Quite quickly, we might be confronted with a difficulty to produce in a number of regions, and plus climate refugees. I was in Cancun, where the farming organizations were also present at the last climate conference, and Jim was there too, Jim Harkness. And one of the very cogent conclusions of that group, expressed by that group, was that we absolutely and absolutely rapidly need to organize an agriculture which needs to be more robust to resist the effects of climate change on the one hand, and on the other hand, an agriculture that will have to adapt to fairly quick pace. All of the elements mentioned at the time were, for instance, to achieve these objectives, family farms are a big asset, knowing that they have a lot of manpower for this adaptation, which is not the case in agriculture, in industrial farms. So my proposal is the following. This thing is, in my view, is very important. It's a major element for the coming years. It's not sufficiently been taken into account by the politicians, and I think it would be good to use the next conference in Rio to put this item on the agenda in that context. Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I have no microphone for the speaker.
Merci.
Thank you. Alain de Baer. I worked as a civil servant in sustainable development. I'm a political advisor now. Alain de Baer, I used to work as a civil servant in sustainable development. Now I'm a political advisor. I'm impressed by everything that was said here, because I was not expecting that discourse here. It's a fairly prospective discourse, and anti-productivistic, and it's you don't hear these things so often, so I find it quite impressive. Now, how do we turn that into action, into political action, tangible political action? I have the impression that we're moving to a Greek-type scenario, or Greece-type scenario. Our agriculture, as it is organized now, is moving towards an abyss. It is carrying along a number of consumers in terms of health. But how can we change that? And when I'm referring to Greece, to the current state of Greece, what is the share of those who have not been involved in the system? What will be their part? Do we simply leave it to the farmers with debts over their heads, or the machinery? Do we tell them, I'm sorry, you were on the wrong track, you need to do something else now, you will produce less, try to muddle through financially, or will society, all of us, me included, do we buy up all this machinery, all these debts, put the counter to zero again, to give them a fresh start? And if we don't do that, how can the farmers believe in that change, and how can they move towards change? These are the questions I'm asking myself now, and I'd like to hear some of your reflections from the organizers or from the other people here in the room. Thank you.
Yeah,
My name is Martin Häusling. I represent the Green Party on the European Parliament, and I'm the Shadow Rapporteur for the GAP reform. If we take a global look, we have to face that we don't have many allies for a reorientation in agriculture policy. I was in Washington with Mark Rouse a short while ago, and we were able to talk to the U.S. government, and I was really dismayed at their view of our agricultural policy. In the American agricultural Secretary of State said, well, 200,000 units should be okay. In Europe, we have 13.2 million units. And he even said that it was no dissensus. Everyone agreed, and we had to feed the world anyway. This was almost a menace when he said that they had to produce 70% more. This is an argument used to intensify agriculture even further. So it is important to do away with these FAO figures, this 70% increase. And the statement by FAO is not that clear, but it is used time and again to boost production and intensify agriculture even further. And this would mean the third revolution in agriculture. China was mentioned as an example. I don't know whether I understood this properly. As an example for rural development. Well, let me make a big, big question mark here. China is also on a route. They are the biggest soy purchaser right now, and so where are the global players we can rely on for reorientation in GAP? Europe is pretty lonely on the global scale right now. We are considered extremely obsolete by North and South Americans, affording a system that could not be translated on a global scale. This is an additional difficulty. Regarding consumers, I don't believe in awareness raising amongst consumers. We have to use prices instead. We cannot allow that meat is cheaper than vegetable or fruits. So this is the point of departure, the price. And this will, at the end of the day, change diets. I don't think that we can launch big nutrition campaigns and thereby ensure that consumers opt for more fruit and vegetable instead of meat. I think we have to introduce taxes or change prices to make it happen.
I suggest that our three speakers get the floor in the end of this session, but meanwhile you collect the themes on which you want to express yourself. Meanwhile, the floor is to the public, the audience, please.
Hello, I'm the co-authors of Eric Matthijs. And I'm from the Institute for Sustainable Development and International Relations in Paris. I just want to get one step further from the question asked by Eric on what does we believe less is more is a good motto for the future, but what are the consequences of that? And we were asked when we presented that in front of DG Agri what that means for competitiveness of the food industry and the agro-food industry in Europe with respect to the rest of the world. And it was not easy to answer, but I think this is a kind of a political answer that we need to build if we believe that less is more is going to be the motto that we want to build upon. And particularly, I think, first, that means for the producers in Europe that redistribution of power and added value along the food chain is, of course, necessary, because I also don't see how that means, what future that would mean for the primary producer. And then for what concerns the competitiveness of Europe, I don't think that we would be listened to if we say it's only degrowth that we will have in Europe and the rest of the world will not. So I think it's important to try and believe that less is more is just an appeal for a change in business models in the whole food chain, and that if we in Europe have the first sustainable food policy that Tim Lang has asked for, it might be a pioneering example that would bring competitiveness to the private stakeholders in the food industry. And I think I don't think that I have the answer, but I think that we definitely need to think of the fact that some of the productionist believers are just saying that there is going to be a rush to feed Asia, even if you think that even if you don't believe exactly in the plus 70% of the FAO, and why shouldn't Europe be one of the runners in this rush to feed Asia? And I think that one of the answers has to be built around what is the business model and the profitability of the motto "less is more." And I just want to really, from the last intervention, to say that we have been, some of the people producing foresights have been really discussing the plus 70% and saying, why don't we consider a plus 30% scenario, just for the sake of putting on the table the possibility of demand management. And some of the foresights that Eric has listed are discussing that. Nevertheless, it's always important to say that FAO does not say it's plus 70% globally and that's it. They say, and the most of it has to come from least developed countries. So that's normally the discourse of FAO, which should not be cut in two, because else it's really just too easy to say that we need to feed Malawi, and that's not what they say exactly. Thank you very much.
Herzlichen Dank fürs Wort.
Thank you very much for handing me the floor. Looking at the European agricultural policy, I feel that my name is Romuald Schaber. I'm a dairy farmer, and I'm the president of the European Milk Board. well, considering the European agricultural policy, I have to conclude that this is crazy. We're actually importing feed and food from 35 million hectares. We're exporting in order to be competitive below production costs of the farmers. And then we actually lament that agriculture can make no contribution any longer to the economy because many of the costs, external costs, are not internalized. We all know that companies only work for profit, so it makes no difference whatsoever who pays for the costs. What's important to them is the turnover. Jim Harkness said, we have to probably think of ways to put certain obstacles to those companies or to put the leashes on those companies. Maybe you can elaborate a little further on how to do that, and above all, how can we achieve cost covering, stable markets for producers and a small margin towards the consumers in order to revitalize rural areas? This is my question to the panel. Thank you.
Oui, Jacques Marais, paysan.
Jacques Marais, I'm a farmer in Poitou-Charentes, France. One remark. I heard to be too big to fall. That's true, if there's only a few, but if all big ones fall at the same time, if it's, well, the big, from the United States, the three biggest car manufacturing companies, only one of them fell, GM, the others were caught. But imagine Greece falling today, well, it's already fallen almost. Might Italy, Spain, Portugal follow? Where will it stop? And how can we prevent the big ones from falling? I think it will be the same when a series of big farms will be fall, whether you have 200,000 of them or more, or 15 million here. It's the same phenomenon. If they all fall at the same time, what next? What happens then? It won't be possible to save everybody, to catch everybody. Not everybody can be made viable again, financially viable. So my second remark on the calculation of prices and profitability. Well, ecological and health profitability of foodstuffs. One very good system is the energy produced as compared to the energy used in the agricultural system. In organic farming, we produce much less, but we hardly use any additional energy, or very little. While in the productivistic farming industry, proportion is completely inversed. So an energy index could be introduced to help, as one could introduce a labor index, but the energy index looks very promising to support the more sustainable types of farming.
Good afternoon, it's
Marco Montiero from Greenpeace. Ich werde mich auch ganz kurz halten. Zuerst einmal, positiv gesehen, die Zeit ist jetzt reif, der Landwirtschaft, Lebensmittelproduktionssystemen endlich die nötige Aufmerksamkeit entgegenzubringen. Das ist jetzt auf der Tagesordnung. Wir haben jetzt wirklich die Chance zu intervenieren und das ist ganz nützlich. Negativ dazu, dieser sogenannte produktionistische Ansatz dominiert die Debatte, leider. Und es ist...
Intensification per se and sustainable intensification is promoted as the only solution and is using all the crises, climate change, food security, biodiversity loss, under the framework of the more with less, is trying to justify any kind of industrial development. And again, we are missing a number of points. Waste, we are missing post-harvest losses, we are missing overconsumption, and we are also missing it's even broader, internalization of external costs. Ways to address these issues are actually within the CAP, redirecting subsidies, making sure that the first pillar is actually going to reward those farmers that do the right thing, meaning providing other kind of public policy, public goods, apart from food production, of course. And a question I have for you, for the speakers in the panel, is do you think the RioPlus20 agenda and debate is going to be an interesting, fruitful, good forum for agriculture or not? Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much also for your discipline in keeping time. I ask the three speakers from the podium, from the panel, to give 1 minute gifts of answers. Let's start with Eric Matthijs. I would say that you... Oh, he went. So let's start with Tim Lang then. There is some...
Eric,
yes. I see you. Oh, sorry. Sorry for that. Eric, the question about awareness of consumers, promotion, the question about post-productionist paradigm, make farmers believe in that and act accordingly, and also the question of fair and sustainable markets and prices. 1 minute.
Actually, that's exactly what I picked up in my notes. That's this is as two people from the floor picked up this skepticism towards behavioral change, and I think they are right. We cannot wait until the consumer becomes aware. I mean, that will take too much time. But we can use instruments, but I think we have to think much more out of the box in also designing instruments. For example, linking up health payments to food prices. I remember this relatively old example from Unilever in France, an insurance company. If you buy, you know, cholesterol low, things like that, you know, there is a whole box, a whole set of opportunities that can be taken there in terms of innovative, you know, VAT, there's all kinds of fiscal instruments that can be used. Second point, don't underestimate the importance of communication and of framing. I think it was several times mentioned that the way things appear on television, to appear in the public, is being dominated by a certain way of framing how we think about food, and this also has to change, and this is actually a huge challenge. And not communicating is also communicating, so it's always an issue of framing, I think.
Thank you, Tim Lang. I would expect a word from you about the redistribution of power along the food chain, maybe, that was raised.
I think that's well said. Well, power is only changed historically when people get organized. I mean, let's be clear. That's not an issue about prices. That's an issue of organization. The reason retailers make the money and traders make the money across the world's food systems is because they've concentrated power. And they have turned market economics on its head. Adam Smith and Ricardo and all the Chicago economists all talk about consumers being in control. The reality is the gatekeepers are in control of supply chains. The only way to do that is to campaign for their breaking up. Now, that's very radical thinking indeed. But if that's what we want to happen, that's what's got to happen. But I think it might happen in very, very different ways. It's another conference. I'd just like to comment on the issue of behavior change. I agreed very much with what Eric said. I'm a psychologist by training, and psychology really came into existence by trying to listen to people as they fall off the cliff and also try to stop them falling off the cliff. That's the origins of psychology of 150 years ago, basically. And essentially what psychology now teaches us is that people's behavior change is very complex. They will resist things, but then the moment there's a crisis, they will do exactly what they were resisting. And what you were talking about, your question, Valerie Carter, was about getting people to change under normal conditions. The reality is it's the conditions going abnormal which will change them. What we need to do, the situation we're in at the moment, is preconditions of shifting. And in that sense, we're doing it. We're already doing it. We're arguing and pushing for it. But the key thing in here, there is a point of confrontation between, if you like, us and the big companies. And I say this to them. You're concerned about sustainable products, damage limitation. We're concerned about sustainable diets and sustainable entire food systems. They're interested in their own supply chains. We're interested in the whole food system. And that is exactly Eric's point about framing. We've got to shift the discussion away from products to systems. Final point. The point that Marco from Greenpeace raised and also Sebastian made as well. It's basically about the politics of this. The answer is there's a big gap between the new agenda of thinking about food and the political discussion with the capital B. We actually have to work on that. I'm doing that myself. I'm now spending more time, since I've left working and advising inside government, now going and talking to politicians and talking to the NGOs in my country who will influence the politicians. I think we have to put more effort into seeding, S-E-E-D, the politicians' thinking. They're not there. They're frightened. Politicians respond. They don't lead. But there are moments in crisis where they have to lead. They have to lead. And what we're having to do is to encourage them to be confident and to be more positive, because they have a very good story to tell, if only they would learn to tell it.
Thank you. One word on climate change adaptation, Rio+20, and maybe where are our global partners considering this +70% thing?
Oh man, I was going to talk about China.
Wait, climate change, Rio+20.
Well, I'll talk about China anyway. Because the reason that I brought up China was precisely because for us civilized Westerners, Europeans and Americans, we would think of China as the biggest villain in whatever area you like. You know, human rights, taking our jobs, destroying the Amazon. But the fact is that, and in fact, in the case of soy, with help from ConAgra and Cargill, they are destroying the Cerrado and the Amazon. But the fact is, if China, during the last food crisis, price crisis in 2007-08, if China had followed the advice of the EU, if China had followed the advice of the US and the World Bank, and depended on world markets to import rice and corn and wheat the way they import soy, instead of having very strong food security policies to promote domestic production, we would not be talking about 1 billion people hungry on the planet. We would be talking about 2 billion people hungry on the planet. So I'm saying that even in a country with a food system that is so messed up, there are things we can learn. And we should be perhaps more humble and more omnivorous in our thinking. China, Brazil, Ethiopia, these are places that where should we should be looking to learn. The reason I'm here is to learn from you.